right, thanks for letting me back on teach you guys again. Really appreciate it. So we're back in 1 Corinthians. We're going to go to chapter 4. We're going to read verse 10 again, and then we're going to go to verse 13. So I'll let you guys get there, and then I'll start. All right, so verse 10 starts, "We are fools for Christ, but you are so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are so strong. You are honored, we are dishonored. To this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags, we are brutally treated, we are homeless. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world." So some fun verses that Brandon gave me to talk about. I am so glad that I landed with those verses. Boy, oh boy, I'm excited. So Brandon told us last week, in the verses before up to verse 10, that the Christian mindset must include the acknowledgement that nothing that we claim ownership of, nothing that we have possession over, nothing about us gives us any reason to lift ourselves up, sort of this message on humility. Our place in this world and our possessions in this world are God-given. They're given to us by God, and that's the reason why we should be humble. And now this week, after Paul tells us why we should be humble, he takes it a step further and tells us a little bit about how we should be humble, what humility does look like and what it doesn't look like. And then he ends by calling everybody trash. So let's go ahead and pray, because this will be fun. God, thank you for calling us here, for God being powerful enough, for being brave enough, and God just having the audacity to bring all of these sinful people into this church, God, calling them your people, God. God, I really do have no reason to glorify myself. God, I have no reason to call on my own name for support, for help, for forgiveness, God, but I call on your name. On Jesus' great name, Lord, is where I take stake in everything that I have ownership of, God. God, nothing I have and nothing I do amounts to anything outside of what you want for me, outside of what you have for me. God, I'm grateful that you put us all here and that you called us here. Lord, let us take this message into our hearts and let us see what we're responsible for. God, let us see what really we need to take agency over and God, how we should live our lives in humility. Pray that you would just open ourselves up, God, that you would let us see deeper into our hearts, into ourselves, that you would let Spirit work in us as we listen to these verses. It's in your Son's name I pray. Amen. All right, let me take a drink of coffee. All right, so today's message obviously is not focused on what humility looks like. We already kind of covered that. But it is kind of what it doesn't look like. So you'll notice in the verses that we just read that Paul is kind of being very sarcastic in the way that he's talking to the Corinthians here. So the Corinthians, have basically, they're saved, they're in the church, they love Jesus, kind of. But Paul is telling them in this letter to them, hey, you guys really need to stop acting as if there's more to this message, that there's more to this church than just Jesus. You guys really need to stop and acting as if there's something that you can add to Jesus' message, that there's something that you can take from it further. So basically in verse 10, he says, "We are fools for Christ, but you are so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong." And that should seem pretty familiar, because it's basically how Jesus would talk to the Pharisees, is, they're acting as if they know everything and as if they're the right ones, and here they have the Son of God right there in front of them, and they don't even realize that the message that he is telling them is so much more crucially important than any of the practices that they're doing, any of the wisdom that they think is correct, any of the corrections that they try to make. Paul is kind of, it's dripping with sarcasm, telling them that, okay, well, we, meaning the new apostles, basically the apostles that appeared, you know, in all of Acts, that came after Jesus's ministry, they're incredibly weak, they're in rags, they're going hungry, but the Corinthians are acting as if they're strong because of Jesus. They're acting as if they're wise because of him, or maybe even in spite of him. So when he's saying you in this verse, he's obviously talking to the Corinthians, and the we is the new apostles, is Paul and everybody else. So once again, it says, we are fools for Christ, but you are so wise in Christ. Well, I was a fool for Christ this week. I just spent the entire week in Vegas for a work trip. And if you know anything about Vegas, it's that being a Christian is not very popular there. And I was actually glad to be reading these verses this week, because it made all of the decisions that were presented to me much easier, because I recognized that to everyone else, I did look like a fool. To everybody else, you know, refusing every drink and staying sober the entire time, and telling them, you know, I can't go to the nightclub tonight. I'm preparing my sermon for church on Sunday. It makes you look like a bit of a fool. And Paul is sort of recognizing right here that to the rest of the world, every decision that you make as a Christian looks kind of foolish, because you're taking everything that the world tells you to do and you're flipping it on its head, and you're saying, I don't want any of that. I don't want what the world makes popular. I want what Jesus says is popular. And what Jesus says is popular is a lot of unpopular things. And so when Paul says right here that we are fools for Christ, he's not making fun of Christians. He's not saying that, you know, we're all dumb for believing this. Instead, he's saying what we should be doing when we humble ourselves is we're following Jesus so closely and we're monitoring what he wanted for our lives so intimately that it looks to the rest of the world as if we're fools, as if we don't know what we're doing, because everything that we are doing, all this, the decisions that we are making, look so incredibly opposite of what the world is kind of indoctrinating us all on. To the Corinthians, this would have been kind of a shock to their system, because they obviously lived in Greece, and in Greece, thinking was sort of what they did best. You know, they philosophized, and they developed all these new systems of thoughts, and they were very, you know, they were very proud of how much knowledge they had. And so for Paul to go ahead and tell these Corinthians, who treasured knowledge so closely, that you need to abandon everything that you learned and instead focus on what Jesus' words told them, that kind of would be a little bit of a shock to their system. To the Corinthians, being a Christian was kind of something rebellious. It was something to flaunt about, because they were stepping out into something that was new and weird, and it, you know, rebelled against everything that Greece had taught them and everything that was popular in the city of Corinth. And what Paul is saying is basically, you know, you can be rebellious, and you can be, you can forsake all of this worldly wisdom, but at the same time, he's pointing a finger in their face and is telling them directly that, you know, a Christian life isn't one of glorification like you're making it out to be, although it is rebellious, and it isn't proud and mighty, although it is very wise. He's telling them you need to deny all this Greek wisdom in order to supplant it with Christian wisdom. Well, what's Christian wisdom all about? Christian wisdom is all about, like I said, taking things that seem to make sense in the world, that the world says is true and right, flipping it on its head and making it the exact opposite. The essence of Christian wisdom is taking whatever thinking is popular right now and making it the exact opposite. For example, like first shall be last, when you're struck, turn the other cheek. do not repay evil with evil, but give a blessing instead. All of these sayings, all of these proverbs and everything else, they don't make sense immediately because it takes what feels right to our flesh and it replaces it with what the Spirit says is right. It takes whatever seems to be right and then it flips it on its head and makes it kind of the reverse. That's what Jesus kind of brought. John Piper has a sermon called How to Get Wisdom, Become a Fool. And I like that because it meshed with verse 10 directly. And I wanted to be clear that Christian wisdom and Christian law are kind of different in that Christian law does make sense because God designed it that way. As in, you know, everything to do with respecting your parents and everything to do with marriage and everything to do with, you know, like don't murder people. Those all make sense internally because God designed the world to be that way. But how we should live our lives, the different ways in which we can walk out into our life, that's when Jesus kind of came and with Matthew 5, you know, the Sermon on the Mount sort of flipped everything upside down and said to the Pharisees, you know, blessed are the meek and blessed are the weak and everything else that seems to be sort of dirty and forsaken is now good and is now right. And that's where we get into the next verses coming up. So verse 11, to this very hour we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. And even on to the next verse, we work hard with our own hands. So Paul is telling the Corinthians here that they're doing the things that the Pharisees did while Jesus was still alive. They're claiming to be, you know, they're claiming to be strong and they're claiming to be right and correct. And they're not really living out this life that even Jesus lived, where he himself was hungry and thirsty. Jesus himself was in rags. Obviously, he was brutally treated. He was also homeless. All of these things are what we should be okay with receiving from God if that be his will for us. It's not something that we should scorn and laugh at and something that we should not want to be. It's something that if God wanted it for us, we should be able to accept it. And in Paul's life, all of these things were true as well. So given a reason to suspect the false ideas given to the Corinthians as being inadequate, Paul doesn't give them something sweet. He forces something sour on us. Like, make no mistake, this is totally a rebuke. If you cheat to verse 14, I am not writing this to shame you, but to warn you as my dear children. So he didn't want to just provide them with reassurance and pats on the back because he needed to let them know that, hey, you guys are doing something totally wrong here. I want you guys to flip your you know, all these ideas that you're bringing into this church, and I want you to instead focus on what Jesus brought originally, and that's what you should be building your church on. It would be like so easy for Paul to draw back in the Corinthians with just all these sweet promises and everything else, but instead he finds more conviction with pointing a finger in their face and rebuking them directly and then giving them some really tough promises for them to swallow. He's obviously not concerned about how many people go to the church in Corinth. He's more concerned about their hearts. He's more concerned about, do you guys actually love Jesus? And if you do, then why does your life not resemble it? Why are you forsaking all of these ideas and all of these the different ways in which he lived his life and making a mockery of it and clinging to all these you know Greek ideas that we need to increase our wealth and that we need to live lives of splendor and live lives of pleasure? Why are you turning to that all of a sudden now that you have this new life instead of first looking at Jesus's life and saying that that should more closely resemble what the Christian life should look like? In one sentence, all of these verses, what they basically communicate is you say you love Jesus, but does your life actually reflect it? If we do love Jesus, if we claim to be part of his church, then we're content with these images. We know that God will deliver us from them. We believe in his promises that all of these different ideas of being in rags, of being brutally treated, of being homeless, obviously we don't want them. Our flesh wants to push those back, but we need to acknowledge at the same time that it is a real possibility for us because of this new life and this new salvation, this new faith that we now claim hold of. Being a Christian brutally treated is something that should hopefully make sense to all of you, especially to those of us that are in college right now, where being a Christian is, the least popular thing on campus, probably. And it's because, sort of like in Corinth, all of these new ideas are presented to all of these immature and young people, and they see the immediate benefit from them, and they see sort of the pleasure that they can derive from all of these activities and everything that feels right to our flesh, and instead they're just being led right to destruction. It's you need to rely on being counterintuitive to the world in order to cling to what Jesus wants for us. So if these verses scare you and confuse you, it's totally fine. I mean, it's totally natural for you to think, I don't want to be homeless, I don't want to be brutally treated. But I think worldly thought has conditioned us to believe in these ideas and to totally, dash them out of our mind and to think against them and to believe that it can never happen to me. And instead, what Paul wants us to do is remember that Christian wisdom flips all of that around, and being brutally treated and being in rags and working hard, all these different things, is something that God may have for us in store. And it's merely just part of what the Christian life actually means, what it actually looks like when we live out humility, when we live out this idea that nothing that we work for, nothing that we own, is truly ours. It is given to us by God's blessings. So with this verse, I mean, there's just a couple of questions that you need to ask of yourself. Is the milk and honey, worth the wandering? Should we aspire to be like the Israelites who needed suffering and all these long years of submission to finally know the goodness of God's deliverance and his care for his children? Like, why are we afraid to do God's will when it includes pain? Does pain help us see God more clearly at the end, or does it drive us further away from him? Should I avoid suffering at all costs, or just trust in God when it inevitably affects my life? Because suffering will happen. It's promised to us. Verse 12 says, we work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. So he's continuing on with this idea of what does humility look like? Well, again, it looks like whatever makes sense to us, forget about that. Let's do what Jesus wants us to do and endure suffering, endure persecution, bless others when we're cursed, and to work hard with our own hands. Can someone bring out a calculator real quick? Daniel, can you open your calculator? Just real quick. Okay, can you add these numbers up together? 6, 9, 8.5, 7.5, 7.5. What does that equal? 38.5. All right, so 38.5 miles I walked in Vegas this past week while at my work convention. So I might not have worked hard with my hands, but I did with my feet, walking around this convention center all week. So this verse, I read it and I was like, we do work hard with our own. I did actually work hard with our hands. I held camera equipment all week. That was about 20 pounds of it that I carried around. So I worked hard with both my hands and my feet. When I read the first sentence of this verse, I was like, I can totally agree with that. I know what that feels like. I totally know. But then I read the second part of that verse, and I was just like, I'd rather not think about that one. Let's go back to the start. It says, when we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. But back to we work hard. So if anybody knew about working hard, there's obviously Paul. Paul was a tent maker. He was actually a tent maker while he was in Corinth. And being a tent maker, you know, was not a very exalted profession in Greece at that time. In fact, nobody liked tent makers because they smell bad. They worked with just this like really disgusting, rank smelling goat hair all the time. They didn't make much money, and they kind of just worked on the outskirts of town because of the materials that they worked with and because of who they were actually servicing. And so Paul, being a tent maker, he wanted to provide for himself instead of just relying on the compensation from local churches and everybody that he was working with, because he knew that he wanted to work hard and that he wanted to provide for himself. Let's very quickly turn to Acts 20, 34 and 35. Acts 20, 34, 35 says, "You yourselves know that these hands of mine have supplied my own needs and the needs of my companions. In everything I did, I showed you by this kind of hard work we must help the weak, remembering the words the Lord Jesus himself said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" That right there at the end is another example of Christian wisdom where it doesn't make sense, but it's right because Jesus said so. What did Paul do with his work? What did he actually accomplish? Well, first, he earned money for himself. He provided for himself. But second of all, he provided for others. And keep in mind that being a tent maker, he didn't make much money to start with. But still, he found ways with what measly compensation he did get for his profession, he still provided for others. And why did he provide for others? Because he knew that Jesus wanted him to bless the weak, because it's better to give than to receive. That's what working hard is actually all about. It's about providing for yourself and adding value, but also so that you can bless others. That's what humility looks like. It's not working hard, so that you can, you know, gain status and that you can acquire more wealth. You want to work hard so that others can be blessed because of your hard work. And then moving on to the second part of that verse, we'll finally talk about it. It says, "When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it." Let's go to Matthew 5, 10 to 12. This is the Sermon on the Mount. And this is where Paul gets this idea. "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So Jesus himself is saying that the Christian life, when we follow him, when we love him, we're persecuted because of it. And not only are we persecuted because of it, but we're supposed to be glad because we are persecuted. What does that even mean? I don't like that. I don't want to listen to that. I want to go back to the happy, happy, fun, fun, joy verses. And focus on those. But instead, Paul is telling the Corinthians, hey, when you actually love Jesus, when this is actually real to you, when you are rebelling against the world in actuality, what it looks like is that everybody else is saying that you're wrong. What it looks like is that everybody else is telling you that you're following something that doesn't make sense, that it doesn't work, that it has no bearing in the real world. Everything that we do, it doesn't make sense, and everything that we say or that we tell others to do doesn't make sense either. All of it is kind of totally against what this world and what all these other systems of thought are trying to convince others to do. And really, when that happens in our life and when that happens out in the actual world, when we do what Jesus wants us to do, you know, we will be persecuted. Others will say, well, you can't be spreading this around because it contradicts everything that I know. It contradicts everything that I've been taught. It's a system of thought that's so contradictory and that's so unpopular that other people will go out of their way to rebel against you and will go out of their way to persecute you? What other system of thought, what other religion would say and willingly call themselves fools? There's no other system, no other religion would say that being a fool for Christ is a good thing, that being a fool for Christ and being submitted to him and being submitted to this person that existed 2,000 years ago, that lived on the earth 2,000 years ago, that's probably a better way to phrase that, is something good, something that you should want to be as a fool. It was hard for me to accept the fact that because of the persecution that Christians face, that we are blessed because of it. And we are persecuted because our message flips the world's thinking on its own head. Christian wisdom is upside down, and I didn't want to accept that I should rejoice because of my persecution. And walking along that train of thought, I think it becomes much easier to realize that when I am persecuted, that when I am unpopular, that when I do go to Vegas and nobody likes me because I ruin everybody's night by being sober the entire time and by not going out to parties and not clubbing and everything like that, that when I go home and work on my sermon in my hotel room, that that means I'm following him more closely than I would be if I was at the club or if I was out on the floor or anything else. It's a good thing in your life when your life so closely resembles that of Jesus that people treat you the same way that he was treated. It's a good thing when people treat you as if you are scum and that you are garbage, and we'll get to that later with that last fun verse. It's a good thing when that actually happens and when that when people treat you like that, because it means that I am more closely resembling my Savior. It means that I am more closely following him, because other people hated Jesus for what he brought. Other people hated him. They put him on a cross because his teachings were so unpopular. So Paul is telling the Corinthians, hey, you shouldn't live your life so that you can be accepted. You shouldn't live your life so that you can be popular. You should live your life so that you can more clearly resemble Jesus, so that you can more clearly come back to what you wanted, you know, why you wanted to be a Christian in the first place, because Jesus' message was so compelling, because it was so revolutionary, because it showed you love for the first time, because you realized that all the bad things that you did didn't matter in terms of what Jesus meant to you and what he brought into your life. Christ's message can even directly contradict people's own thoughts about themselves and flip it on its head. And this is, you know, something that a lot of you have experienced, where you think that nobody loves you, and Christ instead says that he loves you. When people tell themselves that there's no escape from the bad things that I've done, that I can't get away from the terrible person that I am, and Jesus says that he loves them and that he forgives them and that he wants them close to him. When people tell themselves that life has no meaning and Jesus instead brings the fact that he is the way and that he is the truth and that he is the life, everything that we tell ourselves, Jesus flips that on its head and is able to tell us and tell the Corinthians in these verses that we don't want to appear like the world, that we don't want to be accepted, and that we don't want to follow all of these other systems of thought that, while they do seem, you know, they have some truth in them, and while they do appear rather compelling and all their arguments seem to make sense, it doesn't matter when it comes to following what is most important in our life. We shouldn't be able, we shouldn't need anything else other than Jesus. We don't need Jesus and something else. We don't need Christianity and something else. What we really need, and what Paul is trying to tell the Corinthians right here, is that none of that matters when it comes to actually following Jesus and realizing and humbling yourself enough to come to terms with the fact that all of these things will be true in our lives as Christians, and that's a good thing because it looks to Jesus. It glorifies him more accurately. So Paul is constructing the Christian life by deconstructing the norms that the secular world has established errantly. And then we get to verse 13, and he says, when we are slandered, is that the right verse? Yep. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth and the refuse of the world. So we talk about deprivation and humiliation. And there's actually a Wikipedia article that I found I think it's called Foolishness of Christ or something like that, and it literally goes back to this verse. And it frames it as sort of this very old tradition where these Christians, I forget what century, but these Christians who claim to be, you know, of the school of the foolishness of Christ would intentionally deprave themselves, would intentionally follow these verses to a T, and I don't really know if that's what these verses are communicating. I don't think that intentionally sabotaging yourself in order to appear like these verses is what he's actually trying to say, because what that is doing is that is saying that I need to humble myself, not because he is glorious, but because I am a sinner. And that's not what Jesus wants us to think. He doesn't want us to humble ourselves because we are so bad. He wants us to humble ourselves because he is so good, because he is so glorious, and because his message is so much more important than anything else in my life. I should be okay with all of these things that could happen to me, with all of these trials that are presented to me. Let's go to Lamentations 3. Because I just, you know, Lamentations, when your message isn't happy enough, you just go to Lamentations to make it even more bright and fun. What did I say? Lamentations 3? Lamentations. Yep, Lamentations 3, verses 40 through 45. It says, let us examine our ways and test them, and let us return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and our hands to God in heaven and say, we have sinned and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. You have covered yourself with anger and pursued us. You have slain without pity. You have covered yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can get through. You have made us scum and refuse among the nations. So that's one of the verses where Paul derives this image of being scum, of being the refuse of the world. And what do these verses actually mean? Well, the writer is begging the Jews to recognize how they've clung to the world instead of the Lord. And he's setting out a prayer to God to confess their sin so that they might finally be forgiven and return to being his people. Paul's being very clear here that there is not only a clear difference between being a Christian and being of the world, but there is a difference in how Christ sees us and how the world sees us. Christ sees us as forgiven, and everybody else sees, they don't see that part of our life. They don't see the forgiveness part. They don't see the glorification part. They just see that we're the scum of the earth. They just see that we're the refuse of the world because of what we follow, because of the messages that we preach, because of the actual man on which we base our lives around. They see that part, and what they're not seeing is what Christ calls us to be. He considers us precious. He considers us his children. He considers us treasures. We must be content that God may have us rejected and despised and ill-used, and that this might be the reality of our lives because of how he sees us, because he sees us as his precious children, because he wants to refine us, he wants to refine our hearts and call us closer to him. So we're called to service and evangelism, and in all respects, thinking of others and caring for others before ourselves, knowing full well that this same compassion, this same blessings, these same blessings, the same treatment as you know, as we deserve, may not be given to us the same way. That all of this pleasure and all of this comfortability might be denied to us because of the life that we live. But occasionally we don't want to fall into either of those routes. We don't want to follow the narrow path. We don't want to follow the wide path. We want to have Jesus. We want to have church, and we want to have Christianity. But we also want to cheat over and have a little bit of the world, because a little bit is all right. And as long as I'm not on the wide path, as long as I'm kind of on the skirts of the narrow path, I'll be doing just fine. And that looks like, you know, well, I don't want to be rich and famous, you know, I don't want the world, but I mean, having money and being a little popular sounds really nice. And then, I don't want to indulge in everything I have. I don't want to have all these pleasures, but I want to feel comfortable and I want to feel blessed. And instead, Paul is telling the Corinthians, hey, the world is going to treat you as the scum of the earth and the refuse of the world, and you probably will go hungry and thirsty and be in rags and be brutally treated and be homeless. You can't have the best of both worlds, because the best of both worlds isn't what Jesus is saying. It's not what his message is. If we want Jesus and we also want something else, if we want Jesus and we want popularity, if we want Jesus and we want money, if we want Jesus and we want the Seahawks to win another Super Bowl, that's not what the call of our heart is driving us towards. It's driving us towards only needing him, focusing solely on him, and being content that if we have nothing else, as long as we have Jesus, our life is perfectly fine. That everything else can go wrong, everything else can be taken away from us, but the one thing that can't is our faith. The one thing that can't is our salvation. Are you willing to claim that for yourself and say to yourself that even if everything is taken away from me, even if I am homeless, even if I am brutally treated, even if I am in rags, even if I am hungry and thirsty, as long as I have him, that's what's important to me. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, that's not what's important to you guys. What's important to you guys is that you have Jesus and also that the world sees you as wise. That you have Jesus and that you also are treated well. That you have Jesus and all of these other things that we see in verse 10, where they want to be strong and they want to be honored, that all is useless when it's secondary to what you're searching primarily for. When Jesus is the sole thing that you put your treasure in, that you really want to seek in your life, everything else not only is secondary, but everything else is useless compared to that. Everything else shouldn't matter because of what's set out in front of you with your faith. Everything that Jesus wants for you is second to what everything the world has for you. And that's the message that Paul is trying to drive into the Corinthians' head. Like I said, verse 14, he's not writing this to shame them. He's not writing this so that they feel terrible, although they probably do when reading these verses. He's not telling them that they're garbage and that they're the scum of the world because they need to feel ashamed of their faith, but because they're being warned that what they're setting their hearts on isn't as pure and isn't as necessary as what they need to set their hearts on primarily. And we see that all throughout chapter 4. What Paul is telling us and is telling the Corinthians, you know, we notice that he starts out that verse with up to this moment. So even right now, we're being treated in the same way that the early church was. Even right now, these verses should not just make sense to us, but they should be living or appearing in our lives currently. When we know our hearts and when we know our minds and when we know our actions are set on him, these verses should seem very familiar. We should know what being hungry and thirsty feels like. Not to bring it back to Vegas, but I skipped two or three lunches this week, so I know what being hungry and thirsty feels like. But these verses start to become more familiar, not because we're seeking them out and not because we're intentionally doing all these things, because we want to live out what Paul says is true and what we know that the Corinthians were failing to do. These verses become familiar to us when we live out these verses that Brandon brought us last week. When humbling ourselves because we know that nothing that we have is given or nothing that we have is ours, when we know that nothing that's given to us we earned, when we realize that everything that God wanted for us and everything that is given to us is directly from him and no other source, we can be content that when it is taken away, it's not because we failed, it's not because we didn't earn it, it's not because we don't deserve it, it's because God himself is choosing our life, or is choosing his will for us, and we need to be content with that. We need to be content that even if these verses appear true in our lives, and they will, if you do follow him, that we are okay with that because we know that that is resembling what Paul wants for us, what Jesus wants for us more specifically, and we know that we are not clinging to the world, we're clinging to him more carefully. Can you recognize that Jesus is self-sustaining, that Jesus is life-affirming, that we don't need anything else, that the way and the truth and the life is Jesus Christ, that nothing else gives us meaning and purpose in this world. Not to say that we need to deny our blessings, like I keep on saying, because that's not what you should be reading in this verse. We've become the scum of the earth and the refuse of the world, not because we ourselves deny any of God's blessings and we, you know, we continue to rebel against the world and rebel against everything that God has given us, but because when we live our lives after Jesus, we look like the scum of the earth and we look like garbage and we look like the refuse of the world to the rest of the world because they're not following the same things that we are, because they're not living their life as if there is eternity after. They're not living their life as if they have salvation and forgiveness, but we are. And when we do that, when we live our lives like that, to everybody else, we look like scum and we look like refuse. But believing in eternity and believing in salvation, we're okay with all these verses. Our heart is content, and it might feel weird, and it might, you know, your flesh might still say, I don't want to be any of those things. And like I said, that's perfectly fine. But you do need to assess your heart right now and ask yourself and ask, you know, your heart directly, would I be fine if God left me hungry? Can I rely on Jesus if he left me thirsty? Will I call on his name when I'm brutally treated in this world? Will I draw closer to him when all of these things appear true and my life here on earth feels so temporary and feels so mismanaged and has so many of the qualities that everybody else says I should be looking for and looking to achieve in my own life? If I can really be true to what Jesus wants for me, I know that he doesn't want me to look to this world for gain, to look to this world for satisfaction. I draw my satisfaction on everything that comes after. I draw my pleasure on everything that comes after this life. And so when Paul lives his entire life, and he lives it as a tent maker, and he lives it in jail, and he is persecuted for all these things, I mean, we can just look at his life and know that that is what the Christian life looks like. It looks like being mistreated and really just denying or sort of denying yourself before God, knowing that he will take care of you and that all of his promises are true. And that's okay, because we have something to look forward to after this life, that we have something to look forward to that isn't just readily apparent right here on the earth. So whether we're learning from Paul or Apollos, and whether we're going to church in Tempe or Mesa or anything else, we need to realize how being a fool for Christ is paramount to glorifying him instead of ourselves. We don't live for ourselves, we live for someone else. And that's Christian wisdom right there. It feels like the opposite of what's true in this world, but we know it's truth because Jesus wants it for us. Let's pray. God, I realize that this, everything I have here, God, this life that I live, God, while it is ordained by you, and while you care for me, and you think of me as precious, and that everything I have in this world is given to me by you, God, I realize that I don't need it. I don't need it. God, what I need is you. What I really want in this life, what I really want in this world is nothing that this world can offer me. God, I'm okay if I'm brutally treated. I'm okay if I'm homeless. I'm okay